Mr. Media Interview. On today's show, I'll talk to cartoonist Bill Griffith, whose new graphic novel is Invisible Ink, my mother's secret love affair with a famous cartoonist. Stick around. If you thought you knew Griffey through his long-running Zippy the Pinhead comic strip, wait till you read this. Cartoonist Bill Griffith has always shared bits and pieces of his life, his worldview, and maybe even a neurosis or two, through his personal window on the soul, Zippy the Pinhead. In fact, as regular readers know, Griffith, as Griffey, often plays sidekick to Zippy in the long-running Daily Comic Strip. But in his latest work, Griffith takes readers deeper into his real life than ever before. His subject matter? Mom. It seems that Barbara Jackson Griffith led a most interesting life outside of her marriage, carrying on a years-long affair with her employer, a married man, who was well known in the industry that Barbara's son would eventually become an American master in cartooning. In Invisible Ink, My Mother's Secret Love Affair with a Famous Cartoonist, Griffith takes us from his moment of discovery through the amateur sleuthing that revealed ever greater details of his late mother's most profound secret. Reading Invisible Ink, you'll be hard-pressed not to laugh, drop your jaw, and occasionally squirm uncomfortably as a legendary cartoonist draws scenes of his own mother in bed with a not-so-legendary cartoonist of an earlier era. The book has already received a mainstream acceptance that has often eluded Griffith. Entertainment Weekly's website, for example, proudly offers a sneak peek at several pages. NPR and the Toronto Globe and Mail reviewed the book, and Frances Mouly, wife of mouse cartoonist Art Spiegelman, together with Mina Kaneko, interviewed Griffith for The New Yorker. Now, Bill Griffith has a history with Mr. Media that goes back to the mid-1990s, when this was a syndicated newspaper column, and no one could see or hear him. But he most recently joined us in 2012 to talk in depth about Zippy. Bill Griffith, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Glad to be here, Bob.
Glad to see you. Glad to talk to you. Thank you for enduring all the pain that it took to get you here with Skype.
I'm Skype updated. Thank you for that.
You are all courant.
Yes.
Bill, years ago, I wrote a series of short stories framed around the made-up conceit of my mother's virginity, as if she would tell me about it. And the title always drew laughs, but the content made everyone uncomfortable, myself included, so it will probably stay in my desk drawer forever. Is there anything but AIDS that can make a man comfortable telling stories, let alone drawing his mother as a sexual creature?
The time came in my book, Invisible Ink, where I had to do that. I was dreading it and putting it off for several months, thinking it would be just what you said, squirmy and wince-making and way too Oedipal. In fact, when I started to do it, it just flowed out of me. What can I say? I decided that I'd already known in such great detail what my mother's affair was like, both in the mundane sense and in the carnal sense, through reading her diaries and an unpublished novel in which she details the affair using fictional names, that when I came to actually having to draw sex scenes with her lover, it was kind of, I don't know, can I say, it wasn't anywhere near as traumatic as I thought it would be. My main thought doing it was, don't get excited. Just don't get excited and everything will be okay.
Is that the word that you meant to use? Don't get excited?
Don't get excited. So I kept things in shadow. I used more cross-hatching than usual.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Just the idea of doing it is amazing. I mean, and I ask you about if it's because you reach a certain age where those things don't bother you so much. Of course, you know, unfortunately, your mom is not with us any longer. There's that aspect of it, I guess, too.
Yeah, well, something I didn't put in the book, but I've mentioned a few times since. In 1974, right in the middle of my underground days, working on the latest issue of Young Lust comics, Young Lust number 4, which was in full color, that issue, I did actually deal with this subject very briefly in a one-page strip in which I showed a middle-aged woman having an affair with a cartoonist, and I think there was even a sex scene on his drawing table. I made the cartoonist look a lot like the man who my mother really did have an affair with, but I changed names. Then I really did squirm a lot, and I couldn't keep it up in the sense of keeping the sex scene going more than the one page, and that's as far as it got. But you're right, with age and distance and some modicum of wisdom, that just didn't seem like an issue to me at all.
Well, it is interesting that there are a lot of flashbacks in the book, back to what happened with your mom, but also what you're thinking at times. I am surprised, now that you mentioned that you didn't reference back to that page, in that you recreated a lot of the cartoonist in question, Lawrence Larrier's work, rather than, you didn't copy and paste his, you reproduced things. So I'm kind of, now that you mentioned it, I guess I'm surprised to hear that you had dealt with this, but you didn't reference back to that in the book.
Well, because I made them fictional characters, I guess, and it was one page, and it didn't lead to anything. It had a kind of surfacey quality. It just didn't have any depth to it. I think I wasn't ready to look at anything deeper than just the kind of titillating aspect of it. And I remember at the time, my mother was, of course, very much alive and reading my comics, and I was hoping she would not recognize herself, and as far as I know, she didn't. And of course, that issue is completely gone now. She's been dead since 1998. So I did, just before I started doing the several sex scenes of her and her cartoonist lover, Lawrence Larrier, I had a dream the night before, and it's in the book, in which my mother appeared to me zipped up in a sleeping bag lying on my drawing table. And I come down in the morning ready to go to work, and there she is. And she wakes up, unzips her sleeping bag, gets out, and says, "Well, that was refreshing," and looks at me and says, "Now get to work." I took that as the go-ahead.
I like that. And so you brought up something I didn't think ahead I would ask you, but so your mother, and this was, we're talking about the early 1970s, was she read your work, like Young Lust and other things?
My mother read my work from the very beginning.
Interesting. And did that ever cause you any discomfort or her?
It caused her quite a bit of discomfort.
And, I can't imagine why.
And I mentioned it in the book, too. There's a point in the book where I quote from a letter she wrote to me in the early 70s where she says, "Tell me, dear son, how do I tell my friends about your work? Since it's often X-rated and pornographic, what do I say to them when they say your son draws dirty pictures?" She literally wanted me to advise her on how to speak to her friends about my work. I must have written her back, but I have no idea what I said, and I have no idea if it would have helped.
Well, but curiously, she didn't say, "Son, I love you, but I can't read any more of your work." She just said, "How do I explain it?" That's wonderful parenting, frankly.
I had very different parents. My father was aware of my comics from the very beginning. He actually saw a copy of Young Lust number 1, that's 1970, for sale at a newsstand in Penn Station in New York, and wrote to me proudly telling me that it was for sale there, but he never picked it up and he never read it. My mother, on the other hand, read all my work and critiqued it to me very often.
That's amazing.
You have to realize my mother was far from being prudish. Her unpublished novel that I used quite often for source material for my book is full of sex scenes, and they're pretty graphic.
Now, was that... Well, okay, before I come to the novel, I got to ask, because one of the most incredible aspects of Invisible Ink is that your mother apparently lived with great guilt about this affair, but it didn't slow her down from cheating on your dad. Do you mind telling people how her secret came tumbling out, or would you rather not go into that, you know, in terms of giving something away?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm perfectly willing to do spoilers for the book, but the one and only time my mother confessed to me her affair, which lasted from 1957 until 1972, all during my early and late teenage years and throughout my early career in underground comics. She confessed it to me 15 minutes after my father had died in a bicycle accident. We were all in the hospital waiting room. The doctor came out and said, "We couldn't save your father." And I looked at my mother and my sister, and we started to cry and just in a state of shock. And within a few minutes, my mother gathered herself together and said to both myself and my sister, "I have to tell you something now, because if I don't tell you now, I'll never be able to. I had a long and happy relationship with a man you knew slightly named Lawrence Swarrier." I looked at her and didn't know what to say and didn't say anything. And that was the only time we ever talked about it.
It's an incredible aspect of the story. I mean, the whole story spins on that. And, of course, she says that you sort of knew him because, well, ostensibly what you knew is that she worked for him. She would go into the city, right? And
she was his secretary.
Right, right. But and you knew that, and your dad knew that, but you guys didn't actually know. Now, one of the things that recurs in the story is this idea of your dad as someone who, you get to know your mother through what you've discovered of her novel and her letters and, you know, what family you can find out from family. But you're as knowable as she becomes. It's the opposite with your dad. You still don't really know your dad very well.
No, although the book ends on a note where I do get to know him before I was born through a series of letters, which I discovered at the end of the book, at the end process of doing the book, I discovered these letters. But yes, my father was a mystery man. He never, ever, ever talked about his childhood or his family. Of course, when you're a kid, you don't ask either, you know. I never said, "Dad, how come you're not telling us about your family? Please fill us in." You know, when you're a kid, you just think the adults are in a separate world from you. And if they're not going to tell you stuff, that's fine with you, because it's probably going to be embarrassing anyway. And so I never asked. He grew up fatherless. I knew the few facts I know about him from my mother. She knew almost nothing, but she told me what she knew. He grew up fatherless in Hell's Kitchen, in Manhattan, when it was Hell's Kitchen, way, way before it was gentrified, on 20th Street, between 8th and 9th Avenues, a rough neighborhood at that time. He had at least two siblings, because I got his birth certificate, and there they are listed, one of whom lived with him until she was 15. I checked the New York City census records and found that out. I also went through Ancestry.com and found out things about his family, none of which he ever spoke about. This is a man, he had a sister that he lived with until he was 15 years old. I don't know what happened to her at that point. He lived with her and his mother in this little apartment on 20th Street. Never, ever mentioned that she existed to anyone in our family. So, yes, he was pretty buttoned up.
He's portrayed slightly disguised in the novel. Was it harder to hear your mother tell the story, to reveal that she had had this affair? Or was it harder to read the novel that she wrote about basically her life in disguise?
Well, in the novel, she created a version of my father that's much more melodramatic, or maybe, to be kinder, dramatic than he really was. In the novel, he's not buttoned up. He's seething with all kinds of rage that comes out. He abuses his daughter and sexually abuses his daughter, which my father did not do to my sister. He drinks heavily. He is a businessman who fails in business enterprises. My father was a career army guy who, when he retired from the army, worked for the post office. Nothing dramatic about that. So the father that appears in the novel is quite a different father. And in the novel, my father, the fictional version, does discover the affair dramatically. He actually suspects it and then discovers it. My real father, that's a matter of conjecture. Did he know? All I can think is, how could he not have known after 16 years?
I wondered about that. I mean, even reading it, I was wondering, is this one of those things where he knows and he just chooses to just turn a blind eye? So to speak?
Well, or they both work out a truce. They had an unhappy marriage, and divorce was too shameful for both of them. I know that. My mother told me that. And so this was their way of dealing with it. She had her affair, and he put up with it.
After your dad passed, after the accident, and your mother has told you this incredible secret, she's unburdened herself, does your relationship and your sister's relationship with her change? Does she see you guys differently? Obviously, I mean, you're grown-ups at this point. You're adults. But, I mean, does the relationship change in any measurable way?
My relationship with my mother?
Yeah.
Well, yes, but not because of her confession, because as I said, I was too stupid to talk about it, just as I was too dumb to ask my father about his past. Several years after my mother confessed her affair, and we were writing letters back and forth, I never brought it up. When she came to live in San Francisco, where I lived at the time, in 1980, also never brought it up. Never was discussed. She never brought it up, and neither my sister or I ever brought it up. So in that sense, it didn't have any direct bearing. She went from Larrier to a second marriage, which was very unhappy, which my sister and I had to rescue her from. And when she came to San Francisco, she started up another affair with another married guy. And that I knew all about. She talked about it with me. I met him. So that was her modus operandi. She probably had at least two affairs that I can put together when I was very young, before Larry as well.
On the cover of the book, she is winking, and there's all these men surrounding her. She's very big. The men are very small, which I don't know if there's a great significance to that in terms of the sexes, but they're all just so taken with her. And I mean, can you separate yourself from the son and say, you know what, my mother was a knockout. She was a beautiful woman, and men responded to her.
My mother was very pretty. Yep. She won several beauty contests in her life. These figures around her are drawn, well, they're my redrawings, but completely accurate depictions of Larrier cartoon characters. One of Larrier's specialties were google-eyed guys ogling big-busted chicks. It was one of his stock in trade. He did a book called How Green Was My Sex Life, which is just filled with, you know, it's a traditional, almost vaudevillian model of a small, google-eyed, ugly-looking guy trying to gain the attention of a tall, busty wench. You know, that was the source of hundreds of his newspaper and magazine gags. And those characters on the cover, that they're taken from his How Green Was My Sex Life gag book.
Got it. So that puts it into perspective for me. That's interesting. And then you wonder out loud, because, of course, you find out later, you know, when you find out that your mother has been having this affair with Larrier, and there was discussion between them apparently about whether he should get involved with helping you with your career. And then you wonder, you know, would he have taught me his technique?
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, once I began to delve into his career, which started with just the usual Google image search, you know, which I expected to produce, you know, a half a dozen images, because he's so forgotten these days. This is a man who was very well known in his time, utterly forgotten now. Instead of a few images, hundreds, if not thousands, of images come up when you Google image Lawrence Larrier. He was so prolific. And there's just so much out there that I was inundated with examples of his work. And I remembered, as I'm looking at this stuff, all of the books that were in my house when I was a kid, where these images come from. We probably had the complete Lawrence Larrier collection, because my mother worked for him, and she would come home with his books. She didn't have a lot to do with his cartoon books. She worked for him as a secretary for his crime novels. He wrote 16 crime novels in which the detective or the milieu of the where the crime takes place are in the cartooning world. He had a cartoonist detective named Homer Bull, who solved crimes that took place in the world of New York City gag cartoon people. It's very interesting stuff. Pretty good writing, too. Anyway, that was her function. But she would bring home his cartoon books. And I remember how they affected me. I, at that age, 12, 13, I thought this would be a great career. I think it had a lot to do with him. There was no direct contact, but as with all the other things that came to me through Larrier, they came through my mother. He was almost a shadow father. And at several points in my mother's novel, the Larrier character asks her about her son and can I mentor him? And my mother asked me once in a letter if I wanted to send my work to Larrier. This was in the early 70s, and maybe he'd have some comments. So he was aware of my work, but in my book, I conjecture that my mother would never have wanted this to happen. It was way too dangerous to have any direct contact. He was, in my research, looking into his life, I didn't contact them directly, but I found several people who had been mentored by him. Larrier lived in a town called Freeport, Long Island, about 15 miles from where I grew up, in Levittown, Long Island. And there were a number of people, kids at the time, living in his neighborhood that he taught cartooning to in his home, just out of the generosity of his spirit. As if he wasn't a workaholic enough, producing crime novels and gag cartoons and comic strips, he mentored kids in the neighborhood. So yes, he probably would have liked to mentor me under the right conditions. And he did, in a way, but only through my mother, through his work.
I will probably get handed my butt for saying this, but as I read the book and learned about Larrier and the kind of the sexist cartoons that he would do with women, with the breasts and the men's eyes, the comic strips that he did, that he had all these different sideline things that he did, the mystery novels, how to do the cartooning. I kept thinking, and I just want to say, when I mention this name, I have no knowledge, no suggestion whatsoever this man ever cheated on his wife, but I kept thinking in terms of the career of Will Eisner. Same period of time, they worked, in the same era. They had some of the same ups and downs. Larrier did the detective novels. Eisner had The Spirit, Denny Colt. He did that series of books, I guess in the late 60s, early 70s, that were, how to do gardening, how to date, how to do this. I just kept thinking, wow, this is really weird. If Larrier was a nom de plume, if you will, a lot of this echoes a lot of Eisner's life and the way his career went.
Well, I never thought of it, but you're absolutely right. And I wouldn't be surprised. In fact, I'm sure they did have some professional connection. Larrier was the go-to guy in cartooning for hundreds and hundreds of other cartoonists. He was like a clearinghouse editor. Cartoonists would write to him asking where they should submit their work. He would tell them where. He would connect them up with agents. His wife, Larrier's wife, was the first cartoonist agent in New York. A lot of people that Larry or New used her as their agent. And like I say, he was involved in every level of cartooning. Larry contributed a story to the first American all original material comic book in 1934, New Fun Comics. He was contributing to comic books before Superman, before Siegel, and before the Superman number one ever happened. Larry was involved with comic books.
Well, there too, there's that other similarity to Eisner. Eisner was doing comic books shortly after, I think, New Fun. I don't think but he was right around that time. He and Iger joined up and started, producing things under multiple names, as I think Larrier did as well.
Yes, he did. Right? Larrier was a hustler.
Yeah, exactly. That was it.
But there is a slight, not a slight, a big difference between Larrier and Eisner. Eisner's work,
of course,
is wonderful. Larrier's work is, there's a reason why it's forgotten. There's not much nutrition to his work. You know, once you've seen the Guys and Gals Gags and the How to Draw Cartoon Books, you don't want to go on looking for a lot more. Which, by the way, is not true of his crime novels. They are very good. They're not Raymond Chandler, but they're in the hard-boiled detective ballpark, which is the one I like, the genre I like, and I've read them all, and they're quite good.
Interesting, though, and I'm going to let this go in a second, but it had, why can't I think of him? The guy who did the great comic book heroes. Help me, Pulitzer Prize winner.
You mean a book?
Yeah, well, the cartoonist. He worked for Eisner at the end.
Jerry Scott?
No, I'm sorry. I can't believe I can't think of his name. Very famous cartoonist.
The
Village Voice cartoons. I feel like we're playing Password now. But if he had not written about Eisner and the Spirit in the great comic book heroes in the mid to late 60s, Eisner would probably be largely forgotten at this point because he resuscitated his career. So, I couldn't help but, maybe I'm a little too close to the Eisner story, but I couldn't help but think of Eisner as I read this book.
I think it's a valid analogy.
Well, let's come back to the book. How long did you weigh the idea of actually doing this as a book, and how many ways did you tell yourself that it was a bad idea?
I have been kind of talking to myself for decades about why I haven't done a graphic novel. I watch everybody around me doing them. I know I'm perfectly capable of doing one, and I, for years and years, kept asking myself when and what will it be, and I sort of thought it would eventually happen, but I didn't want to push it. It just had to happen of its own accord. It happened just as it is described in the book. I paid a visit to my uncle because he wanted to show me a box of family memorabilia photographs.
Uncle Al,
still alive and kicking with every marble intact, 91 years old. And he and I started talking about our family, and my aunt, who was alive at that time, this is about 3.5 years ago, she passed away about a year ago. My aunt, who was a Baptist church-going church lady, surprised me by asking me if I thought my mother ever had any affairs. And when I told her, yes, probably, she said, oh, good for her. While I'm completely revamping my view of my aunt, Elle, in this moment, I said, well, of course, you've heard about her affair with Larrier, haven't you? And they looked at me and said, who's that? And that was it. I was staying in a hotel for a few days because my aunt was quite sick. and I didn't want to burden them with my visit. So I went back to my hotel room after that evening with Uncle Al and Aunt Nell. And I sat there and I Googled Larrier because he was swimming around in my head from what I had just described. I just described him to them. And the book literally took form in about 2 or 3 hours sitting at the desk in my Holiday Inn Express room in Winston-Salem. And I furiously wrote everything that popped into my head. And in the morning I looked at it and I said, okay, you've got your graphic novel. There it is.
And it's interesting because it's rather organic to your body of work because you reference what you do. You don't try to do this graphic novel and set aside what you've been doing all these years. You embrace it and you move on. It's you and it's a piece of your life. And for me, that's why it works so well as a graphic novel.
Well, it's kind of an autobiography. It's a mixture. It's a mixture of detective story, autobiography, family saga, and biography. Biography being of Larry. And since it was kind of seeming to want to be told on all those different platforms, I thought that would be the way to organize it, to not make it linear and chronological, which of course is not how I think anyway, after all these years of doing Zippy. So I decided to do the weaving in and out of present, past, and conjecture, and the source material I had, my mother's diaries and her novel, and to use a lot of stuff and just try to weave a story that told itself through all of these aspects. It was the biggest challenge of the book. And at any given moment while I was doing the book, I would read it over and realize I had to add three pages of bridge material because the changes were too abrupt. My wife, Diane Newman, was tremendously helpful in that regard. She would tell me wherever she saw any glitches or continuity problems, which of course I immediately said, what are you talking about? This, it's perfect. Everything is perfect. And then 5 minutes later, I'd go fix them.
And I have to ask you, now that the book is done and out, and has Diane said to you, Bill, if I go first, please don't tell that story about me?
No, she and I have kind of, I don't know, we have a pretty good understanding of each other. We don't hide anything from each other. So there's nothing that either of us is going to reveal at some later date that we already haven't revealed. So.
And has Uncle Al read the book?
Yes, and he read it in stages. After I finished the book, before it was published, I went down to visit him, and I told him about the book.
Over buffet, I'm assuming?
Over what?
You went to the buffet and you told him at the buffet?
At the K&W cafeteria.
Yes, sorry, the cafeteria. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's where we had a lot of our conversations, where they offer 18 different forms of starch with every meal. So I told him about the book. He, like my mother, he has read he's read my books. He's read Zippy through all the different anthologies that have come out. And whenever he gets a new one, he either calls me or writes me and tells me how much he liked it. And I get a very clear feeling that he indeed has read the stuff and he likes it. But this was hard for him to understand when I told him about this book. He never heard the term graphic novel. And I told him it was a story that's told in comic form with balloons. And it's all done by hand. He got all that. But he didn't really understand how this could be a book. So I let it go. Then when I got my first copy, my advance copy, this was a couple of months ago, before it was in the bookstores, I took it down to Winston-Salem and I brought it to him. And I said, here's the book I was talking about. You're in it. You're a very big part of it. And he was curious. And I opened it up and I started to read it. And I read the entire book to him from first page to last page out loud. He stopped me every 30 or 40 pages and rubbed his eyes and said things like, Bill, this is incredible. This is unbelievable. Bill, this is major. You've done something very important. And when it was finished, he got it. He understood what I had done. And this is a guy who didn't know what the word graphic novel meant. But he got it. So I was very relieved and happy.
Now, I apologize that I don't know. Is your sister still with us?
Yes.
Has she read the book?
Yes, and she has not yet given me her complete comments, although when I handed it to her and she first leafed through it, she said, you know, Bill, you and I have very very different ideas of our mother.
Not unusual there. Not
no.
Unusual there.
A lot of times siblings really, when they describe their parents, they don't seem to be the same human beings. So
I will make another Eisner reference, because Pete Eisner, Will's younger brother, loved their parents, absolutely loved them, thought they walked on water. Will had a very low opinion of both parents, particularly his mother, and they could never, they just had to agree over the years to disagree about whether their parents were good people or not.
So, yeah, well, that's pretty standard, isn't it?
It is. Would you advise at this point, now that the book is out, obviously it's getting good reviews, I definitely put it in the category of can't put it down, because I read it right straight through myself, but if someone else is thinking about doing a graphic novel, or just a novel, let's say, where they spill family secrets, would you advise for it or against it, based on your own experience?
Oh, absolutely for it. I teach comics once a week at the School of Visual Arts in New York. For the past 4 years, I've been doing that. And I teach a course called Storytelling, a name I did not give to the course, but it's okay. And what I tell the kids is, my kids, they're 19, 20 years old. Whenever they do something on their own without being assigned a specific limited subject, they do zombies, they do vampires, they do all kinds of superhero, not superhero Marvel type, but they invent superheroes. Everything has to be unreal to them to be exciting and interesting. All I can think of is they've just played too many video games as children. I don't know what it is. But I tell them, put that aside. That was in your childhood. Put that aside. Look at your life. That's your material. You may not think it because you're 19, 20 years old, but you now have such a perfect access to your childhood. You're only 10 years away from it. That's your material. That's what makes you different from other cartoonists. They can't have that material that is only yours. And that's what I advise them to do. And that's what I would advise anyone to do that wanted to do a graphic novel about their family. Go for it.
Well, all right, so one more topic and I'll let you go. You've been very gracious with your time, as always. I want to touch base about Zippy. We haven't talked about Zippy at all, except just kind of offhandedly. This beloved character of yours has been around now, I don't know, 40 years, 50 years? How long has it been?
The first Zippy strip was 1970 at Underground Comics. So what is that?
45 years.
45 years. Ay, ay, ay.
That's right. Now, have you thought about what his life will be like when you're not around to guide him? Are there plans in place?
It will be in the grave with me.
Really?
Yes. Not that there's much danger of this happening, but I did make a deal in my contract with King Features, who syndicates my daily Zippy strip, that when I go, Zippy goes. Nobody can. There's no next in line cartoonist waiting to do Zippy. Nor, I think, would there be anyway. Who's going to do it? You know, it's like, I don't have, I'm not like the family circus with 1,200 newspapers.
Well, so in that regard, are you, now the last time we talked, you told great stories about Hollywood's efforts to do Zippy as cartoons and that kind of thing. There won't be an ongoing comic, but are you shutting down Zippy entirely? Would, you know, if someone wants to
No.
Buy the rights from the estate to do a film or something?
I actually, funny you should ask. Diane and I just did our wills. You know, we redid our wills about 6 months ago. And I had to think about this very question. We don't have kids, but we have two extremely close nieces, one of whom was almost a daughter to us for a while. She lived with us all during her teenage years in San Francisco. And I wouldn't deny them the rights to exploit Zippy after I'm gone. What do I won't, I wouldn't care.
So well,
let them go ahead and finally sell Zippy out. And, you know, maybe I'll be the ghost in the the premiere night at Grauman's Chinese Theater, you know, in my silver walker with my wings.
So you've ensured that the comics will not continue.
The comics will not continue, but the right to exploit Zippy in various forms I have actually given to one of my nieces. Yes.
Well, and since you mentioned that you and Diane have redone wills, a story that I've heard over the years, and I don't know if this is common now, but there have been cartoonists, I guess Walt Kelly comes to mind, where his estate and his surviving spouse, they've had problems with the value of comics left behind, and you know the originals and all that kind of stuff. Have you had to deal with that as an issue? I'm sorry, these are very personal questions. If you don't want to answer,
I don't mind answering at all. I took care of that very clearly, and I actually did it. I first started taking care of this problem maybe 20 years ago, but now I updated it. And the way it works is all of the original art and any related material, letters, contracts, everything, from the first underground comics I did in 1968 up until 1986, when I began syndicating Zippy as a daily, that whole period, 1968 to 86, all that material goes to the Billy Ireland Museum, Billy Ireland Library and Museum in Columbus, Ohio, which is in a wonderful, enormous comics archive. And all the rest of it, I just reversed everything. Okay, all the material that I just talked about from 1968 to 1986, all the underground material goes to Columbia University. Okay. They have a very big comics archive now, and a lot of that material was created in New York, and I'd like it to be in a big city like New York where it's easily accessible to researchers. All the material before, all the material from 1986 to the present that is related to my daily strip, all of the King Features original art and related materials all goes to the Billy Ireland Museum and Library in Columbus, Ohio. So,
have you kept all of your art, or do you sell some art? How does that work?
I sell art, but I produce so much of it that I have a huge amount of it. If you go to the Zippy website and you want to buy the original art for a specific Zippy strip, you can ask, and if it's available, I give you a price. But I still have thousands and thousands of daily and Sunday Zippies, and I have probably 75 or 80% of all my underground comic artwork.
Well, now that you've popped your graphic novel cherry, if you don't mind me using a 70s underground comics analogy.
Far out, man.
What's next? Are you going to do another one? You're going to stick to Zippy? What are you going to do?
I'm already on page 27 of another one. I go for a walk every morning around here in Connecticut where I live, which is a rural area. And on my walk, 9 times out of 10, I come up with an idea for the strip, the Zippy strip for that day. On a walk sometime in early June, I was on my walk and I was thinking, gee, my graphic novel is done. It's not out yet, but it will be soon. And there's a few months between I finished production on it, and between that time and the time I'll actually see a copy, and I began to feel kind of like there was a void, you know, there was an emptiness after 3 years of working on that book. And an idea just popped into my head for another graphic novel, which is, it's called Nobody's Fool, The Life and Times of Schlitzie the Pinhead. And it's a biography, but it's kind of a mystery, kind of a detective mystery story in the slightly similar vein to Invisible Ink, about the life of the real Schlitzie, whose actual birth name is not known. And I should know. I've spent a lot of time trying to find it. He was a real person who lived from 1901 to 1971. And he was the number one sideshow attraction in circuses in the world, basically, all over the world. But he was a real person, and I have interviewed three people who actually knew him. One of them is very old, and the others are my age, but they knew him when they were teenagers. Very, very fortunate to find these people. And I'm trying in this book to make Schlitzie human, not a freak, not simply a weird sideshow person, but the human being he was, albeit obviously mentally challenged. He had the mind of about a four-year-old child, but he had feelings, he had needs, he had longings, he had likes and dislikes, and I've been able to piece together quite a bit of it. And then there's a huge amount of history that is all, I've done a huge amount of research on that. So, and in the process, it's kind of the story of the American sideshow, because he was in sideshows from the early 1900s up until the day he died. So the whole evolution of the American sideshow is in the book, too.
Well, it'll be very interesting. We'll look forward to that. And obviously, I'll invite you back. We'll update Skype at that time, and we'll have you back when that comes out.
Right, maybe Skype 3, whatever. Yeah.
Well, folks, listen, you can order cartoonist Bill Griffith's new graphic novel, Invisible Ink, My Mother's Secret Love Affair with a Famous Cartoonist. And you got to know there's two exclamation points at the end there. As well as all the Zippy the Pinhead collections, wherever you typically get books about comics, or you can order it right now at a great price from MrMedia.com. If you're watching this on MrMedia.com, below the video, either on the left or the right, you'll see the cover of Invisible Ink. You can click on it. Amazon can get it to you in 30 minutes or less. At least I think that's how they do it with the drones. I'm not sure. Or you can get it in a day or two. So click, order the book now. Bill, website for people to follow up with you is what?
ZippyThePinhead.com. And Bob, can I do one additional little plug here?
Of course.
See this?
Departed Acts.
This is my mother's unpublished novel, which in a few days will actually be available on Amazon.com. You know, they have a publish-your-own book kind of platform called CreateSpace. Are you familiar with that?
I very, very much so, yes.
Yes. So I have uploaded, I'm proofing it now, her entire book as a manuscript, typed manuscript. No alterations of any kind or changes by me. So here's your published novel, Mom, finally.
Oh, how nice. What a good son you are.
I am.
How wonderful. Yes, we'll have a link to that too then.
Okay.
We'll make that available too. Bill Griffith, this is, I think, the third interview we've done for Mr. Media. And I think there was one more in there where I talked to you about Will some time ago when we did the book there. So it's always a pleasure. I can't thank you enough for your time. It's a wonderful book. And thanks so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
You are very welcome, Bob.
Recorded live before a studio audience full of cartoon characters who want to break through from 2D to 3D in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
So you see me?
I do.
Okay.